Natural selection accelerated in silence to 1/100th the speed of light, the point of no return for its fusion fuel consumption. Now unable to return to the solar system under its own power, it had become a lonely boat bound to forever wander in outer space. The commander of the Asian fleet gazed at the stars, trying unsuccessfully to find one in particular, for all there was in that direction was the faint light of the pursuer's fusion engines. A report soon came in. Natural selection had stopped accelerating. A while later, natural selection restored communication with the fleet. Then the following communication took place, with delays of more than 10 seconds between transmissions due to the fact that the ship was now over 5 million kilometers away. Natural selection. Natural selection calling Asian fleet. Natural selection calling Asian fleet. Asian fleet. Natural selection, Asian fleet reads you. Report your status. Natural selection. This is Acting Captain Zheng Bei Hai. I'll speak directly to the fleet commander. Fleet commander. I'm listening. Zheng Bei Hai. I take full responsibility for natural selection's breakaway voyage. Fleet commander. Is anyone else responsible? Zheng Bei Hai. No, responsibility is mine alone. The situation has nothing at all to do with anyone else aboard natural selection. Fleet commander. I want to talk to Captain Dongfang Yangxu. Zheng Bei Hai. Not now. Fleet commander. What's the ship's current status? Zheng Bei Hai. All is good. Every crew member is still in deep sea state, apart from me. Power systems and life support are operating normally. Fleet commander. And your reasons for this treason? Zheng Bei Hai. I may have deserted, but I am no traitor. Fleet commander. Your reasons? Zheng Bei Hai. Humanity is certain to lose on the battlefield. I only want to save one of Earth's stellar-class spaceships to preserve a seed of human civilization in the future, a scrap of hope. Fleet commander. That makes you an escapist. Zheng Bei Hai. I'm just a soldier fulfilling his duty. Fleet commander. Have you received the mental seal? Zheng Bei Hai. You know that's not possible. That technology wasn't around when I went into hibernation. Fleet commander. Then your unusually resolute defeatist beliefs are baffling. Zheng Bei Hai. I don't need the mental seal. I am the master of my beliefs. My faith is resolute because it doesn't come from my own intelligence. At the beginning of the Trisolar Crisis, my father and I began to seriously consider the most basic questions about this war. Gradually, a group of deep-thinking scholars, including scientists, politicians, and military strategists, gathered around him. They called themselves the Future Historians. Fleet commander, was it a secret organization? Zheng Bei Hai, no. They studied very basic questions, and their discussions were always conducted in the open. The government and military even came forward and held several academic conferences on future history, and it was from their research that I arrived at the mindset that humanity is doomed. Fleet commander, but the theories of future history have since been proven incorrect. Zheng Bei Hai, sir, you underestimate them. They not only predicted the Great Ravine, but the Second Enlightenment and Second Renaissance as well. What they predicted for today's era of prosperity is virtually indistinguishable from the real thing. And finally, they predicted that humanity would be totally defeated, wiped out in the Doomsday Battle. Fleet Commander, have you forgotten that you're on a spaceship capable of travelling at 15% of the speed of light? Zheng Beihai. Genghis Khan's cavalry attacked with the speed of 20th-century armoured units. The mounted crossbow of the Song dynasty had a range of up to 1,500 metres, comparable to 20th-century assault rifles. But it's impossible for ancient cavalry and crossbows to compete with modern forces. Fundamental theory determines everything. The future historians clearly saw this point. You, on the other hand, have been blinded by the dying radiance of low-level technology and are luxuriating in the nursery of modern civilization, without any mental preparation whatsoever for the coming ultimate battle that will determine the fate of humanity. Fleet Commander, you come from a great army, one that was victorious over an enemy with far more advanced equipment. It won victory in one of the largest land wars in the world, relying solely on seized weapons. Your behaviour is a disgrace to that army. Zheng Beihai, my dear commander, I'm more qualified than you to speak of that army. 3 generations of my family served in it. During the Korean War, my grandfather attacked a Pershing tank armed with a grenade. The grenade hit the tank and slid off before exploding. The target was barely scratched, but my grandfather was hit by machine gun fire from the tank, had both legs broken under its treads, and spent the rest of his life an invalid. But compared to 2 of his comrades, who were crushed to a pulp, he was lucky. It's that army's history that so clearly taught us the significance of a technological gap during wartime. The glory you know is what you've read in the history books, but our trauma was cemented by the blood of our fathers and grandfathers. We know more than you do what war means. Fleet Commander, when did you conceive of your treasonous plan? Zheng Beihai, I repeat, I may have deserted, but I am not a traitor. I conceived of the plan the last time I saw my father. I saw in his eyes what I needed to do, and it took me 2 centuries to realize my plan. Fleet Commander, and to do this you disguised yourself as a triumphalist? A very successful disguise. Zheng Beihai, General Cheng Wei, sir, almost saw through me. Fleet Commander, yes, he was keenly aware that he had never worked out the foundation of your triumphalist faith, and his suspicions were only aggravated by your unusual enthusiasm for radiation propulsion systems capable of interstellar travel. He had always been opposed to you joining the special contingent of future reinforcements, but he couldn't breach his superior's orders. He warned us in the letter he sent, but did so in your era's subtle way, and we overlooked it. Zheng Beihai, in order to obtain a spacecraft capable of fleeing into space, I killed 3 people. Fleet Commander, we did not know that. Maybe no one did. But one thing is certain. The research direction chosen at that time was crucial for the subsequent development of spaceflight technology. Zheng Beihai, thank you for saying so. Fleet Commander, I will also say that your plan will fail. Zheng Beihai, perhaps, but it hasn't yet. Fleet Commander, natural selection's fusion fuel is only at 1/5 capacity. Zheng Beihai, but I had to act immediately. There would be no other opportunity. Fleet Commander, what it means is that you're only able to accelerate to 1% of light speed now. You can't consume excess fuel, because the spaceship's life support systems still need power to maintain operations for a time span that could be as short as a few decades or as long as a few centuries. But at that speed, the pursuing force will catch up to you quite soon. Zheng Beihai, I still control natural selection. Fleet Commander, true. And of course, you know our concern. That pursuit will drive you to continue accelerating, expending fuel until life support fails and natural selection becomes a dead ship at near absolute zero. That's why the pursuit force won't draw near natural selection for the time being. We have confidence that the commander and soldiers aboard will solve their own warship's problems. Zheng Beihai, I'm also convinced that all problems will be resolved. I will shoulder my responsibility, but I still firmly believe that natural selection is headed in the right direction. When Luo Ji jerked awake, he recognized something else that had endured from the past. Firecrackers. It was dawn, and through the window the desert glowed white in the early light, illuminated by bursts of firecrackers and fireworks. Then came an urgent knock at the door. Without waiting for it to be answered, Shi Xiaoming opened it up and charged in, his face red with excitement as he urged Luo Ji to watch the news. Luo Ji watched television only rarely. Since arriving in New Life Village No. 5, he had returned to a life in the past. After the post-awakening impact of the new era, this was a precious feeling for him, and for the time being, he didn't want to be disturbed by information about the present day. He spent most of his time immersed in memories of Zhuang Yan and Xia Xia. All of the paperwork had been filed for their reawakening, but government controls on hibernators meant that it would not happen for 2 months. The television news broadcast the following. 5 hours ago, the Rangier Fitzroy telescope observed the Trisolaran fleet cross yet again into an interstellar dust cloud. This was the seventh time since its launch 2 centuries ago that the fleet had revealed itself by passing through a dust cloud. The fleet had lost its rigorous formation, so that the brush shape it had formed on passing through the first cloud was now altered beyond all recognition. But just as in its second crossing, a bristle was observed extending out in front. What was different this time, however, was that the shape of the track indicated that the bristle was not a probe, but a warship of the fleet. Having completed the acceleration and cruising legs of their journey to the solar system, some of the ships in the Trisolaran fleet had been observed decelerating as early as 15 years ago. 10 years ago, the majority of them had begun to slow down. It was clear now that this particular ship had never reduced speed. In fact, judging from its path through the dust cloud, it was still accelerating. At its current rate of acceleration, it would arrive in the solar system 50 years before the rest of the fleet. A lone ship charging into solar system territory and in range of Earth's powerful fleet would be suicide if it was an invasion. This left just one possible conclusion. It was coming to negotiate. Observations of the Trisolaran fleet over the course of 2 centuries had determined the maximum acceleration of every ship, and projections indicated that this advanced ship would be unable to decelerate sufficiently, so it would pass right through the solar system in 150 years. That meant just 2 possibilities. The first was that the Trisolarans wanted Earth to assist in deceleration. More likely was that, before the ship passed out of the solar system, it would drop a smaller craft that could decelerate more easily, a ship that would be carrying the Trisolaran negotiation delegation. But if they desired to negotiate, wouldn't they notify humanity by Sofon? Luo Ji asked. That's easy to explain, Shi Xiaoming said excitedly. It's a different way of thinking. The Trisolarans have totally transparent minds, so they imagine that we already know what they're thinking. Even though the explanation was unconvincing, Luo Ji shared Shi Xiaoming's feeling, like the sun outside was rising early. When the sun rose for real, the revelry reached a climax. This was just a small corner of the world, and the centre of the activity was in the underground cities where people left their trees and crowded into the streets and plazas, their clothing turned up to maximum brightness to form a glowing sea of light. Virtual fireworks blossomed in the vaults overhead, and at times a colourful burst covered the entire sky, its brilliant light a match for the sun. News continued to arrive. The government was cautious at first, and its spokesperson stated repeatedly that there was no conclusive evidence to demonstrate that Trisolaris had the intent to negotiate. But at the same time, the UN and the SFJC convened an emergency summit to formulate strategies for negotiation procedures and terms. In New Life Village No. 5, a short interlude paused the revelry. A city legislator came to make a speech. He was a fanatical supporter of what was called Project Sunshine, and was taking this opportunity to win the support of the hibernator community. Project Sunshine was a UN proposal whose main thrust was that, in the event of a human victory in the Doomsday Battle, defeated Trisolarans ought to be provided with space in the solar system. There were various versions of the project. The weak survival plan set up Pluto, Charon, and the moons of Neptune as Trisolaran reservations that would grant admission only to those aboard the defeated Trisolaris ships. The living conditions on these reservations would be very poor, and they would rely on fusion energy and the support of human society to sustain themselves. The strong survival plan would use Mars for the Trisolaran sojourn and would eventually admit all Trisolaran immigrants, in addition to members of the fleet. This plan would provide Trisolaran civilization with the solar system's best living conditions apart from Earth. The other versions were more or less situated between these two, but there were also a few more extreme ideas, such as accepting Trisolarans into Earth society. Project Sunshine had won broad support from Earth International and Fleet International, and preliminary studies and planning had already begun, with many non-governmental forces in both internationals pushing for it. Yet it had encountered fierce resistance from the community of hibernators, who had even coined a name for supporters of the project, Dong Guo, after the soft-hearted scholar in the fable who saved a wolf's life. As soon as the legislator's speech began, he was met with strong pushback from the audience, which tossed tomatoes at him. Ducking, he said, "I'd like to remind you that we're in a humanitarian age following the Second Renaissance. The life and civilization of every race are accorded the greatest respect. You are bathed in the light of this age, are you not? Hibernators in modern society enjoy citizenship in complete equality and suffer no discrimination. This principle is recognized in the Constitution and in the law, but more importantly, it exists in everyone's heart. I trust you can appreciate this. Trisolaris II is a great civilization. Human society must acknowledge its right to exist. Project Sunshine is not a charity. It is an acknowledgement and an expression of humanity's own value. If we... Hey, jerks, focus on your work!" The legislator's final line was addressed to his team, who were busily gathering up the tomatoes that had fallen to the ground. They were quite expensive underground, after all. When the hibernators saw this, they began tossing cucumbers and potatoes onto the stage as well, and thus the minor confrontation was resolved in mutual merriment. At noon, every household feasted. On the grass, a sumptuous meal of unadulterated agricultural products was laid out for the city folk who had come to join in the fun, including Mr. Dong Guo, the legislator, and his entourage. The festivities continued tipsily through the afternoon and until sunset, which was exceptionally beautiful that evening. The sandy plains outside the neighbourhood looked creamily soft and delicate under the red-orange sun, and the rolling dunes looked like the bodies of sleeping women. By night time, one news item pushed their flagging spirits to new heights of excitement. The Fleet International had made the decision to combine the Stella-class warships of the Asian Fleet, the European Fleet, and the North American Fleet into a single fleet of 2,015 ships to sally forth in unison and intercept the Trisolaran probe as it crossed the orbit of Neptune. The news propelled the revelry to a renewed climax, and fireworks filled the night sky. But it also elicited some disdain and mockery. "Mobilizing 2,000 warships for a tiny probe? It's like using 2,000 butcher knives to kill a chicken." "That's right, 2,000 cannons to hit a mosquito. It's not that tough." "Hey, everyone, we should be more understanding of the Fleet International. You know, it might be the only chance they'll get to fight Trisolaris." "Right, if this can be called fighting." "It's okay, just think of it as a military parade for humanity. Let's see what this super fleet's got. It'll scare the Trisolarans to death. They'll be so frightened they won't be able to pee. If they even have pee." Laughter. Close to midnight, more news came. The combined fleet had set off from Jupiter base. Viewers were informed that in the southern sky the fleet could be seen with the naked eye. At this, the revelers quieted down for the first time and searched the sky for Jupiter. It wasn't easy, but under the guidance of the expert on the television, they soon located the planet in the southwest. At this point, the light of the combined fleet was moving in Earth's direction from a distance of 5 AU. 45 minutes later, the brightness of Jupiter suddenly increased, soon surpassing Sirius to become the brightest object in the night sky. Then a brilliant shining star separated from Jupiter, like a soul leaving a body. The planet returned to its original brightness as the star moved slowly away from it. That was the launch of the combined fleet. At practically the same time, live images of Jupiter base reached Earth. On the television, people saw the sudden appearance of 2,000 suns in the blackness of space, standing out awesomely in the eternal night of space. Their clean rectangular formation put one thought in everyone's mind. God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. Under the light of these 2,000 suns, Jupiter and its moons seemed to have caught fire. The planet's atmosphere, ionized by the radiation, produced lightning that filled the entire fleet-facing hemisphere and covered it in a giant blanket of electric light. The fleet accelerated with no disruption to its formation, its huge wall blocking out the sun, and then made a stately advance into space with the force of a thundercloud, declaring to the universe the dignity and invincibility of the human race. The human spirit that had been repressed since the first appearance of the Trisolaran fleet 2 centuries ago had finally found total liberation. At this moment, all the stars in the galaxy silently held back their light, and human and God stepped out proudly into the universe as one. The people wept and cheered, and many of them were moved to loud wails. Never before in history had there been such a moment in which every single person felt fortunate and proud to be a member of the human race. But there were some who kept their heads. Luo Ji was one of them. Surveying the crowd, he noticed that someone else was calm. Shi Chang was off by himself, leaning against one side of the giant holographic television, smoking a cigarette and watching the revelers indifferently. Luo Ji went over and asked, "What are you?"
"Ah, hello, my boy. I've got a duty to fulfill."
He indicated the ebullient crowd.
"Extreme joy easily turns to grief. And now's the best time for something to happen. like when Mr. Dong Guo lectured this morning. If I hadn't come up with the tomatoes in such a timely fashion, they would have used stones. Shi Qiang had recently been appointed chief of police for New Life Village No. 5. To the hibernators, the fact that someone belonging to the Asian fleet, someone who no longer was a Chinese citizen, had been given an official post in the national government was a little strange. However, his work had been universally acclaimed among the villagers.
"Besides, I'm not the type to get carried away," he continued, clapping Luo Ji across the shoulders. "Neither are you, my boy."
"No, I'm not," Luo Ji nodded. "I was always out for instant gratification. The future had nothing to do with me, even though for a while there I was forced to become a messiah. Maybe my present state is a sort of compensation for the harm from that. I'm going to bed. Believe it or not, Da Shi, I'll actually be able to get to sleep tonight."
"Go and see your colleague. He just arrived. Humanity's victory might not be a good thing for him."
Luo Ji was slightly taken aback by this remark. Looking at the man Shi Qiang pointed to, he realized with surprise that it was the old wall face of Bill Hines. His face was ashen, and he seemed to be in a trance. He had been standing not far off from Shi Qiang, and had only just now noticed Luo Ji. When they hugged each other in greeting, Luo Ji felt that Hines's body seemed to tremble with weakness.
"I came looking for you," he said to Luo Ji. "Only the two of us, history's rubbish, understand each other. But now, I'm afraid, even you don't understand me."
"What about Keiko Yamasuki?"
"Remember the meditation room in the UN Assembly building?" Hines said. "It was always deserted. Tourists only visited occasionally. Do you remember the chunk of iron ore? She committed seppuku on top of it."
"Oh."
"Before she died, she cursed me, saying that my life would be worse than death, since I'm marked with the mental seal of defeatism, even as humanity is victorious. She was right. I am in real pain now. Of course, I'm happy for the victory, but it's impossible for me to believe any of it. It's like there are two gladiators fighting in my mind. You know, it's far harder than trying to believe that water is drinkable."
After he and Shi Qiang had gotten Hines set up with the room, Luo Ji returned to his own room and soon fell asleep. Once again he dreamed of Zhuang Yan and the child. When he awoke, the sun was shining through the window, and the revelries were still going on outside.
Natural selection flew at 1% of the speed of light on a course between Jupiter and the orbit of Saturn. Behind it, the sun was now small, although it was still the brightest of the stars, while up ahead the Milky Way shone with an even greater brilliance. The ship's heading was more or less in the direction of Cygnus, but in the expanse of outer space its speed was imperceptible. To a nearby observer, natural selection would have seemed suspended in deep space. From its own vantage point, in fact, all movement throughout the universe had been erased, leaving the ship seemingly in a static state, with the Milky Way ahead and the sun behind. Time seemed to have stopped.
"You have failed," Dong Fang Yang Xu said to Zheng Beihai. All personnel aboard the ship but the two of them were still in deep-sea sleep state. Zheng Beihai remained shut inside the spherical compartment, and Dong Fang Yan Xu, unable to enter, had to talk with him through the communication system. Through the section of bulkhead that was still transparent, She could see the man who had hijacked humanity's most powerful warship floating quietly in the centre of the compartment, head bent, intent on writing in a notebook. In front of him floated an interface that showed the ship on standby for ahead four, ready to go at the press of a button. Around him floated several globs of liquid deep-sea acceleration fluid that hadn't yet been evacuated. His uniform had dried, but its wrinkles made him look much older. He ignored her and continued to write, head bent. "The pursuing force is only 1.2 million kilometres away from natural selection," she said. "I know," he said without looking up. "You were wise to keep the entire ship in deep sea state." "It had to be this way. Otherwise, agitated officers and soldiers would have attacked this cabin. And if you took natural selection to ahead four at will, you would have killed them all. That's also the reason why the pursuers haven't closed in." He said nothing. Flipping a page in the notebook, he continued writing. "You wouldn't do that, would you?" she asked softly.
"You never imagined I'd do what I'm doing now." He paused a few seconds, then added, "The people of my time have our own ways of thinking."
"But we're not enemies."
"There are no permanent enemies or comrades, only permanent duty."
"Then your pessimism about the war is totally unfounded. Trisolaris has just shown signs of wanting talks, and the combined solar fleet has set off to intercept the Trisolaran probe. The war will end with a victory for humanity."
"I've seen the news that came in."
"And you still persist in your defeatism and escapism?"
"I do." She shook her head in frustration.
"Your way of thinking really is different from ours. For instance, you knew from the start that your plan would be unsuccessful because natural selection has only a fifth of its fuel and is certain to be caught."
He set down his pencil and looked out of the cabin at her. His eyes were calm as water. "We're all soldiers. But do you know what the biggest difference between soldiers from my time and soldiers now is? You determine your actions according to possible outcomes. But for us, we must carry out our duty regardless of the outcome. This was my only chance, so I took it."
"You're saying that to comfort yourself?"
"No, it's my nature. I don't expect you to understand, Dongfeng. We're separated by 2 centuries, after all."
"So you've carried out your duty, but there's no hope for your escapist endeavour. Surrender."
He smiled at her, then looked back at his writing. "It's not time yet. I need to write down all that I've experienced. Everything across 2 centuries needs to be written down, so that it might be of assistance to a few sober-minded people in the next 2 centuries.
"You can dictate to the computer."
"No. I'm used to writing by hand. Paper lasts longer than a computer. Don't worry. I'll bear full responsibility."
Ding Yi looked out through Quantum's broad porthole. Even though the holographic display in the spherical cabin provided a better view, he still liked seeing things with his own eyes. What he saw was that he was situated on a large plane consisting of 2,000 small, dazzling suns, whose light seemed to set his grey hair aflame. The sight had grown familiar to him in the days since the launch of the combined fleet, but its grandeur still shook him each time he looked. The fleet was not just in this configuration as a show of force or majesty. In a traditional naval configuration of staggered columns, the radiation produced by the engine of every warship would have an effect on the ships to the rear. In this rectangular formation,
the ships were separated by about 20 kilometres. Even though each of them was an average of 3 to 4 times the size of a naval aircraft carrier, from that distance they were practically dots, with only the glow of the fusion engines to prove their existence in space. The combined fleet was in a dense formation, one that had only ever been used in fleet review. In a normal cruising formation, the ships ought to have been spaced at roughly 300 to 500 kilometres, so a 20-kilometre spacing was basically like sailing hull to hull through the ocean. Many of the generals in the three fleets disagreed with this dense formation, but conventional formations presented a number of thorny problems. First of all, there was the principle of fairness in battle opportunity. If the probe were approached in a standard formation, then the ships at the edge would still be tens of thousands of kilometres away from the target when the formation reached minimum distance. If combat broke out during the capture, a fair number of the ships could not have been considered to have taken part, leaving them nothing in the history books but eternal regret. But the three fleets couldn't break off into their own sub-formations, because it was impossible to coordinate which of them would occupy the most advantageous position in the overall formation. So the formation had to be made as dense as possible. A review formation that placed all ships within combat distance of the probe. A second reason for selecting this formation was that the Fleet International and the United Nations both desired stunning visuals. Not so much to show off for Trisolaris, as to give the masses something to look at. The visual impact held enormous political significance for both groups. With the main enemy force still 2 light-years away, the dense formation was certainly not in danger. Quantum was located in a corner of the formation, giving Ding Yi a view of the majority of the fleet. When they crossed the orbit of Saturn, all the fusion engines turned toward the forward direction and the fleet began to decelerate. Now, as the fleet closed in on the Trisolaran probe, its velocity was negative. It was travelling back toward the sun as it closed the distance separating it from its target. Ding Yi put a pipe to his lips. With no loose tobacco in this age, it was an empty pipe that dangled there, the lingering flavour of 2-century-old tobacco faint and indistinct, like a memory of the past. He had been reawakened 7 years earlier, and had been teaching in the Peking University Physics Department since then. Last year, he had put in a request to the fleet asking to be one of the people who would examine the Trisolaran probe up close when it was intercepted. Although Ding Yi was held in high regard, his request had been refused until he declared that he would kill himself in front of the three fleet commanders if they did not comply. Then they said they would think about it. In fact, selection of the first person to contact the probe was a knotty problem, because first contact with the probe meant first contact with Trisolaris. According to the fairness principle to be observed during interception, none of the three fleets could be permitted to enjoy this honour alone, but sending someone from each of them presented operational problems and could complicate matters. So the mission had to be undertaken by someone outside Fleet International. Ding Yi was naturally the most suitable candidate, although another unstated reason lay at the core of his request's ultimate approval. Neither the Fleet International nor the Earth International had much confidence in obtaining the probe, because it was practically certain to self-destruct during or after intercept. Before it did so, close-range observation and contact were imperative if they wanted to obtain as much data as possible. As the discoverer of the macro atom and the inventor of controlled fusion, the veteran physicist was completely qualified in this area. At any rate, Ding Yi's life was his own, and at 83, his unparalleled qualifications naturally gave the old man the power to do anything he wanted. At the final meeting of Quantum Command before the intercept began, Ding Yi saw an image of the Trisolaran probe. Three tracking craft had been dispatched by the three fleets to replace Earth International's Blue Shadow. They had captured an image at a distance of 500 kilometers from the target, the closest that any human spacecraft had come to the probe. The probe was about as large as expected, 3.5 meters long, and when Ding Yi saw it, he had the same impression as everyone else. A droplet of mercury. The probe was a perfect teardrop shape, round at the head and pointy at the tail, with a surface so smooth it was a total reflector. The Milky Way was reflected on its surface as a smooth pattern of light that gave the mercury droplet a pure beauty. Its droplet shape was so natural that observers imagined it in a liquid state, one for which an internal structure was impossible. Ding Yi remained silent after he saw the image of the probe. He did not speak at the meeting, and his expression was downcast. "Master Ding, you seem to have something on your mind," the captain said.
"I don't feel good,"
he said softly, and pointed at the holographic probe with his pipe. "Why? It looks like a harmless work of art," an officer said.
"And that's why I don't feel so good," Ding Yi said, shaking his grey head. "It looks like a work of art rather than an interstellar probe. It's not a good sign when something's so far removed from our own mental concept."
"It is peculiar. Its surface is entirely sealed. Where's the engine nozzle?" "Yet its engine lights up. We've observed that. When it went out for a second time, Blue Shadow wasn't close enough to capture an image in time, so we don't know where the light came from."
"What is its mass?" Ding Yi asked.
"We don't have an exact value right now. A rough value, obtained through high-precision gravitational instruments, is less than 10 tons.
"Then at least it's not made of matter from a neutron star."
The captain put an end to the officer's discussion and continued with the meeting. He said to Ding Yi, "Master Ding, this is how the fleet has planned out your visit. After the unmanned craft completes its capture of the target and carries out an observation period, if nothing unusual is found, you will enter the capture craft on a shuttle and conduct a close-up observation of the target. You may not stay longer than 15 minutes. This is Major Xi Zi. She will represent the Asian fleet and accompany you as you carry out your examination." A young officer saluted Ding Yi. Like the other women in the fleet, she was tall and slender, the very epitome of new space humanity. With only a glance at the Major, Ding Yi turned to the captain.
"Why does there have to be someone else? Can't I go alone?"
"Of course not, sir. You're unfamiliar with the space environment, and you need assistance throughout the entire process."
"In that case, I'd better not go. Does someone really need to follow me?"
He broke off without uttering, "to death." The captain said, "Master Ding, this trip is dangerous, to be sure, but not completely so. If the probe self-destructs, then it will most likely occur during the intercept. The likelihood of it self-destructing 2 hours after the intercept is very low, so long as the examination process does not use destructive instruments." In point of fact, the primary reason the Earth and Fleet Internationals decided to send a human to the probe was not for an inspection. When the world saw the probe for the first time, everyone was captivated by its magnificent exterior. The mercury droplet was just so beautiful, so simple in shape, yet masterfully styled, with each point on its surface in exactly the right place. It was imbued with a graceful dynamism, as if at every moment it was dripping endlessly in the cosmic night. It inspired the feeling that even if human artists tried out every possible smooth, closed shape, they wouldn't come up with this one. It transcended every possibility. Not even in Plato's Republic was there such a perfect shape. Straighter than the straightest line, more circular than a perfect circle, a mirrored dolphin leaping out of the sea of dreams, a crystallization of all the love in the universe. Beauty is always paired with good, so if there really existed a demarcation between good and evil in the universe, this object would fall on the good side. So a hypothesis was quickly worked out. The object might not even be a probe. Further observation confirmed this hypothesis to an extent. People first noticed its exterior, the highly smooth finish that made it a total reflector. The fleet conducted an experiment on the probe using a large quantity of monitoring equipment. Its entire surface was irradiated with different wavelengths of high-frequency electromagnetic waves, and the reflectance was measured. To their shock, they discovered that at every frequency, including visible light, the reflection was practically 100%. No absorption was detected. This meant that the probe could not detect any high-frequency waves, or, in layman's terms, it was blind. There must be a particular significance to a blind design. The most reasonable guess was that it was a token of goodwill from Trisolaris to humanity, expressed through its non-functional design and beautiful form. A sincere desire for peace. So the probe was given a new name, inspired by its shape. The droplet. On both Earth and Trisolaris, water was the source of life and a symbol of peace. Public opinion maintained that a formal delegation ought to be sent to make contact with the droplet, rather than an expedition team made up of a physicist and three ordinary officers. But after careful consideration, Fleet International decided to keep its original plan unchanged.
"Can't you at least swap in someone else, letting this young lady..."
Ding Yi said, gesturing at Shi Zi. Shi Zi smiled at him and said, "Master Ding, I am Quantum Science Officer. I'm in charge of off-ship scientific expeditions during our voyages. This is my duty." "And women make up half the fleet," the captain said. "Three people will accompany you. The other two are science officers sent by the European and North American fleets. They'll be reporting shortly. Master Ding, let me reiterate one point. According to the decision of the SFJC, you must be the first to make direct contact with the target. Only then are they permitted to make contact."